Hello and welcome to Maverick Radio Hour. We are coming to you from West Bottoms, Kansas City, in a nice little studio here. This is quite pleasant. Y'all would enjoy it if you could stop on out and check it out. This is on Our Source Radio, and this is a test, but also at the same time, action in practice, as they call it. Because if you can practice and do the same thing at the same time, why not do both? It seems to me that that would be the most efficient way of doing things. What you just heard was a short piano intro. That is what I like to call Cities Past Form Futures. It's a little bit that I've put together over the years. I suppose I might as well go into a bit of my history on music. Lately, it's getting to a level where I can have a decent show and put some songs together. But I've been working on these I've been playing the piano since about 2013 or so, and not classically trained, so I just come up with this as I go. Most of the time, I would find myself at the end of a night and simply wanting to be creative, do my thing, and I just start playing on it and hitting keys until I found some sequence that sounded good. And then I'd repeat that, and I'd make it more complex. And then once I got bored with it, I'd play something else. It's a very simple method, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about logic and method, and the difference between methodology and subject matter, and how that results in an efficient use of mental faculties and effort and energy and all that sort of good thing, and how that relates to the new Renaissance and also the traditional sort of way in which we determine the world around us, science and that sort of thing as well, objective observation and the processing that we utilize in our minds in order to make sense of it all. All the madness and all the craziness out and about us that we seem to have a handle on in some ways, but other ways we need to refer back and adhere to certain logical principles. So we'll go into that a little bit. But first, I'll tell a little story. I really wanted to play music when I was younger, and I enjoyed it. I was pushed into academics and sports, especially, were the things that my family pushed us for, which is great, and I love that. And so music ended up taking a back seat. I liked singing when I was in church, and I did like music class, and it was enjoyable. And I tried, and even applied for one of those little elementary school kid plays for like the Christmas pageant, that sort of thing. And I spent some time in the choirs of church and all of that. But it wasn't until about fifth grade, I think, they were passing around those who wanted to get into an instrument could do so. And they went from one person to the other, and they kind of told us what instrument we were going to be playing. And they gave me the trumpet. So it's like, okay, well, let's play the trumpet for a little while. And I played it, had a class and played it for about a year, but it was, didn't quite do it for me. Wasn't exactly a huge fan. And at the time, I was like, wait a minute. So if I didn't take this, I would have an extra study hall? Oh, perfect. That way I wouldn't have to do my homework at home. Great. So that's what I ended up doing. So that was the first instrument that I got into years and years ago, but didn't really connect to it exactly. But the piano had always been very mysterious, and the incredible great breadth and depth that you can find with this instrument, clearly through any simple look into classical music, to jazz, to ragtime, to rock and roll, and modern pop music. This thing is capable of just about anything. So that seemed much better use of my time, you might say. Or the possibilities being much greater than a three-keyed trumpet. Now, you can do all sorts of things with a trumpet once you really start to learn how it works and how to operate the thing. But the piano seems a bit more straightforward than that, full of keys and everything. So I always found it mysterious. I always wanted to play the thing. And I had a few chances to just sit down at one and just bang out the keys and get a lesson or two from a friend or two who would give me some basics on it back when I was like a late teenager, but never really had a chance to actually work on one. I didn't have one. We never had a piano at our house. There wasn't one that I could regularly access until a friend of mine back in 2013, and this is just after I moved into a new apartment back then. A friend of mine said they're getting rid of their upright piano they have in the apartment that they got. So I said, okay, great, awesome, I'll go get it. I will carry that thing on my back if I have to, darn it. And went to his house, and I brought a dolly with. And we picked the thing up, dragged it out on the porch, brought it over to the street. And he asked, okay, well, where's the truck you're putting it on? I said, I don't have a truck. I said, well, what are you doing with it? I'm putting it on this dolly. Okay, well, where are you going with the dolly? I'm walking it back home. And the apartment was about 15 blocks, something like that, away from my new apartment at the time. And I figured, oh yeah, well, the way to do this is just strap it to the dolly, kick those back wheels out, attach it tightly, put on a yellow vest, and then walk the thing down the street until I get to my apartment and put it in there. It was the most straightforward manner of doing such a thing. Otherwise, to lift it onto a vehicle, lift it into a trailer. Now, I've done that later, but to lift it onto a vehicle, you need someone else for it. This, for the most part, I could do on my own. So I took the dolly. It's about 10 o'clock at night. And I walked this piano down the street in a yellow vest, 15 blocks. But then I ran into a snag. One snag was that I had to get across the train tracks. There was a crossing at one point. And I thought, okay, well, probably the best way, first off, I stopped short of the tracks itself, looked both ways and listened, see if there was a train coming. Didn't hear anything. The lights were fine. The levers were silent. And I thought, okay, let's just move this thing across real quick, and then we'll be all right. And so I got a little bit of momentum and pushed, and then clonk. The front two wheels got stuck on the track. And tried to wiggle it around, lift it up, move it around. Didn't seem to go. And then the dinging starts. Ding, 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 ding. It's like, what the hell? You're kidding me. There's not a train coming. No way. There was a train coming. Small engine train. And in that amount of time, I quickly wiggled it enough and pulled it back that I got off the tracks, shoo, right as the train goes flying by. With a loud horn, too. Wah! As it goes. And after it passed, levers went up, and I ended up getting it across the tracks, and then another block back over to my apartment and put it there, and that's where it stayed. On a side note, it would have been the best worst outcome to this adventure were I not able to get away from the, get the piano off the tracks and the train engine just slammed into it, would have been quite wild, especially if someone had a video camera on at the time, but nonetheless, anyway. So that's how I got that, my first upright piano. This is back in 2013. I got to an apartment. Never since then, it stayed there wherever I was. Wherever I had an apartment, wherever I could have a studio, that thing I always brought with me. And on a nightly basis, I'd just fall in love with it and go at it for an hour or two, something like that, on the regular. Since then, it's been slow getting to the point where I can really play something. It's a long time of just enjoying it, playing it, jamming out, hearing from friends and family, whoever was around, listening to it. Like, that's terrible. Like, no, that's awful. And then they'd come over and they'd play some other songs, and ultimately I'd feel like, okay, well, it's not good enough, so you got to keep going. It's not good enough, so make it better. Still not good enough, make it better. Still not good enough, make it better. And this is the method that I've used in order to get to the point that I have. At later dates, I'll be playing some jams that are, actually, you know what? Let's play one of my favorite little songs here at the conclusion of this particular story. And then we'll move on to the greater topics at hand. So this one, I like to call Delight That Which Rules. So that's a little simple ditty, a simple sonata, as it is. And you can play all over the place with that. And what I like to do is start with something like that and then improvise as I go. And that was made by the method of which I mentioned earlier. Banging around on those keys until you find some sequence that sounds good. And then repeating it. And so that is that's the topic for the day. And to analyze that a little bit more, method as opposed to subject matter. Because subject matter, there's the difference here between the two things. You can look at logic, and you can look at the knowledge that you gain from logic. It's sort of like the journey and the destination type of thing. In the journey aspect of it, you're moving one foot forward after the other, 1 foot after the other, after the other, after the other. Eventually you get to a spot that you call a destination. You can stand there and you can look around on top of that plateau and be like, oh yes, here we are. Isn't this pretty? Yeah. And there might be other people there, there might be other things, that sort of deal. In which case, in a similar manner, with logic, with a method, you get to the subject matter of knowledge at some point. So, for instance, through the logic of symbolic logic of zeros and ones and the binary that comes with it, we created computers, phones. Much of the technology that we use today is based off of this languages that are built on zeros and ones, yeses and nos, if and then propositions. This is symbolic logic that operates in so many different manners that knowing it allows you to really figure out everything else. And having a proper system of logic and a methodology for how it works is the basis for much of the knowledge that we have today. Because anyone could go out and just say something. They could say, oh, trees are green, or the sky is blue. Or they could say, trees are blue and the sky is green as well. Now, are you going to believe them or not? Now, let's say they're talking about something that you don't see, that you can't actually observe with your own eyes. Because right now, this is really important for us these days, especially, that there is so much misinformation and disinformation out there that is attempting to destroy the logic that we have as a human species. The human spirit itself, in a lot of manners, is under attack, as many of us know. And the aspect of that that is most under assault is logic itself. It is that method of us determining what reality is. The way in which we figure out our reality and the world around us and know what's really happening. And that's much more important than subject matter itself. So there's another aspect to that subject matter that is subservient, you might say, to the logic that leads to it. So I like to say lots of times, and I'm not the only one who brought this up, that speaks on this, that is to say, is that for me, the journey is the destination. I like the process of doing a thing. Also, if you check out, I go into this a little bit deeper in regard to stone carving and how that, to me, is quite a crystallization and embodiment of that idea of loving the process as opposed to the final result. And similar with playing piano, and similar with finding out the reality of the world around us. It's utilizing the logic and utilizing the method itself that leads to the subject matter of knowledge. So, that subject matter, this is the other thing too, is that the subject matter of knowledge, and we're just talking here mostly, we might go into a little bit deeper of revelatory knowledge or observational knowledge, but we're sticking with an observational scientific approach to start with. And so, looking at it from that level, the subject matter of what knowledge is absolutely infinite. Absolutely infinite in so many manners that it's impossible for any being that is, except perhaps God, to know all of the things that are around in our world. Like, for instance, Do you know the shade of the color on the carburetor on the left side of your vehicle? Probably not. Somebody might know. But you would have to go in there and look at it and see it and observe it in order to know what that is. Is that important? Maybe it is, probably not. It seems pretty arbitrary. But that's, now what about the color of the shading on the right side? What about the color of the shading of some other part of a vehicle that is hidden? What about this particular brick on this building? Is it porous or not? How porous is it? I mean, all these bits are subject matter of knowledge. And most of the time, that subject matter really doesn't matter, pun intended, unless it has some sort of value to you. There's some sort of reason that, okay, well, this brick is porous. That's pertinent for the structural integrity of this particular building, et cetera, et cetera, on and on. So that subject matter is absolutely infinite. And we can't hold all that information inside our heads. And who would want to? It's ridiculous. It's absurd, you know. And in a similar manner, the best way to utilize our mental faculties is to adhere to a method and a system of logic in order to determine these particular subject matter knowledge bits of the world. Because our brains can only hold so much, our memory can only hold so much, we can only do so much with our bodies, minds, and spirits. And having the method and the logic behind it is like having a solid processor in your mind, that if you really make sure that thing is well oiled and well greased and you know how to use that, then you can figure out anything on the spot, right quick, just based on minimal subject matter knowledge. And then you can extrapolate from what you know to be true to determine what you have not necessarily seen with your own eyes and ears and senses. And this is vital, because right now a lot of what's happening, and this is one of the big ruses that the population is being put under, and that we have been put under for a very long time, is the subject matter itself is what's being obfuscated. The subject matter itself is what's being is what the lies are. That's how they show up. You see, liars out there, they can't alter the methodology and logic of our minds. They can only offer subject matter lies. That's why if you have that logic and you keep to that method and you keep that processor well greased and working well, then you won't be able to be swayed or conned or grifted, at least not as easily. Now, someone can come up with a lie on subject matter and tell you that, well, that tree that you haven't seen is actually 2 inches tall, and really there's fairies and leprechauns running around it. And if you haven't seen that, if you haven't been there, well, you could believe what they say, or you could not necessarily. Now, does that fit with the method of the logic that the pattern of which you've determined through your actual subjective knowledge that you can confirm of your own objective senses? Because that's the reality that we can determine for ourselves. And the logic that we find based on that can help us to understand what else is happening in the world. So if someone says that, that's a subject matter. That's a subject matter lie. But they don't necessarily have the ability to alter your logic, to alter that method. So it's a bulwark against corruption. And that's what's really being under assault right now. Because subject matter lies can happen all over the place. And someone can tell you that a mask will prevent a cold, you getting a cold. And, like, okay, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. There's plenty of methodology, plenty of objective control trials, randomized, that show that there's no real evidence of that. But if you really believe it, it might actually work for you. Maybe it does. That's the power of the placebo effect. This is something that has been notable for some while. If you really believe in that lucky rabbit's foot, then you might have some good luck. It works the other way too, as well. If you really believe that something's bad luck, then it'll turn out to be bad luck. And really, that's what it comes down to. Belief is another. That's another ballpark when it comes to subject matter, journey, destination, methodology, and subject matter. That realm of knowledge, belief, and revelatory knowledge is another ballpark. Again, we can go into that some other time. But I would really like to hammer home this point, and that logic is what is vital to be adhered to, not only for the reason that it creates that reality around us, and if you don't have that, then I mean, all sorts of horrendous things can happen: mass psychosis, tremendous, you know, anarchy and chaos amongst people, us having a complete inability to really connect on any sort of level of reality, that sort of thing. But besides which, it also allows you to get to astoundingly high levels of knowledge by adhering to that logic. In that, it's not always necessary to retain in one's mind all of the bits and pieces of subject matter knowledge, but rather, when it's needed, all of those bits and pieces of subject matter knowledge can be recreated on the spot, boom, with the processor that operates through that logic and methodology. Now, this is the way that I operate when it comes to mathematics as well, geometry particularly. So I've been a land surveyor for some years. I started off back when I was a teenager when my dad got me out there. And we own a surveying business, and it goes very well. And it's been wonderful to have this work. It's quite rewarding. Yet exercise, part-time out in the field, part-time in the office, get to draw maps, do math, hike around, see nature, and everything that comes with that. But particularly when it comes to the mathematics of the geometry, the way that I operate on that is that there are some basic principles of that geometry that I adhere to, and when needed, I use those base principles to extrapolate the answer when needed. So, in a practical sense, you might remember the way it works is this. There are equations that would allow one to determine the angle of an obtuse triangle, of 1 foot of the obtuse triangle, based on knowing the lengths of 2 of the legs. Now, there's a specific formula in this case that can be used in order to determine that particular angle. And it's long, it's got a bunch of different characters in it, it's hard to remember, right? Now, I know some other surveyors who remember that formula, and they remember all the formulas, all the different formulas that are needed in order to determine this particular angle or this, the length of this particular side, based on what information you have at hand. So what they end up doing, and often enough this works for them, is that they remember all these different formulas. And so whenever the problem shows up that has these particular inputs that they know, and they're trying to find out this thing that they don't, they pull out that particular formula that relates to those particular metrics that they have access to, and they use it, and they figure out the answer and then move on, right? Well, the way that I would work on this is that I go off of the more primal formulae, like Pythagorean theorem and sine, cosine, and tangent, just the basics there. And when I run into a problem that those of themselves are unable to immediately solve based on the metrics that I'm given in order to find some unknown, what I do is I break up the triangle into pieces that allow those more primal and simplistic formulae to get that metric that I'm looking for. So, in which case, what this is exactly what I was talking about earlier, is using the formula, using a more base logic, and processing in order to determine that end result, but leaving out the subject matter, in this case, the more complex formula that relates to more specific instances, adhering to the less complex formula that applies to further instances, many, many instances, and transforming the question on the spot is the way that I determine this. So, whereas there are entire chapters that are devoted to the particular formula and trigonometry that are necessary to determine this particular angle based on having these two lengths and or this particular length based on having these two angles, and so I just skip that entire chapter and I just stick with the Pythagorean theorem. Now, what'll happen is it'll take me a little bit longer in comparison to the other surveyor to determine what the answer is here. But nonetheless, there's an entire part of my mind that I keep open for memories of other matters, such that having a more simplistic strategy that can be adjusted on the spot for just about any situation appears to me better than the having all these different specific strategies that are only helpful in those particular situations, in very particular situations that don't even necessarily come up. So it's an efficient manner to utilize one's mind, and this is quite intentional on my part that I utilize it so. And it goes back again to that ultimate methodology and logic, adhering to the process more so than the end result, that appears to me most vital in our lives in determining what the reality is around us. So, considering that, we can go further into a few other issues. Namely, is the, once again, I think it was last week, no, it was 2 weeks. It was last week we didn't do a recording, but 2 weeks ago we did. We might have had it going live. Maybe. It was hard to tell at the time. We're still getting the working out the kinks here at the source, putting together some content. And but I was going off on the really for my purpose the most important idea that I've figured out really in my entire life, that there was a mission that was given to me so long ago, something like 15 years ago. And there's a little story on that. I remember I was with a friend of mine. We were at a bar. Often enough, we'd just go out and we were hanging out at a place that I remember they had a hand shuffleboard, which is a lot of fun. We ended up playing some of that, you know, the kind of like curling or that sort of thing. Very smooth little devices. What are they? What do you call those? Balls, discs, pucks. Yeah, kind of like a puck, I guess. Yeah, it should be puck. Anyway, so they had shuffle boards there, which is out of the ordinary. But remember, we were having a little conversation, and I was telling him about this was about 15 years ago. I was 21 at the time, and we had recently gone down the rabbit hole of the 9/11 truth movement. And there was documentaries that came out back then. I'm talking 2007, 2008, 2006 especially. It seemed to come out, and they seemed to come out around that time. A bunch of them all together. And so we were getting into politics and talking about this, and I was saying that, man, this is nuts. I mean, how can this be happening? How could they do this to us? That sort of deal. Particularly when it comes to the smoking gun on that particular day, and also the smoking gun on that particular day was the collapse of Building 7, that shows that the story that we've been told is not quite accurate. There's more to it, at the very least. The exact details of that day, I don't know, and I can't necessarily tell you for sure. I wasn't there. And also, since it was recently the anniversary, I would like to say my condolences to everyone who lost their loved ones in this horrific attack, and the tremendous damage that it's done to our country and the world. It's a shame, and people who are really behind this will be brought to justice, and sometimes it takes a while for that to happen, but I do believe and have faith that that it will. But also, we were talking about this, and I was telling them that this is crazy. You know, how can we be put upon this? You know, this is a great lie that's not being properly investigated. And why is it not being investigated? Well, probably because there's a few people, there's some certainly in various positions who gain some sort of power from the perpetuation of a lie. And that's a shame. And it's not the only time that that sort of thing happens. This one's just very visible. You know, there's con artists and grifters everywhere, and they can gain money, power, high standing positions and culture through abuse, corruption, through any number of manner. And it's a shame that this occurs. But we have a free society. Some people are like that. Some people are psychos. Some are sociopaths. It happens. They just are. Now, if we have a society where if you try to construct a society where that sort of thing doesn't occur amongst the individual, then you don't have freedom. And that's not a world I want to live in. Now, I believe that people are innocent until they're proven guilty. That's the side of that coin that that I stand on, as opposed to the other, from the other direction. That's a nightmare. It really is. And in a way, that's kind of what a totalitarian society, if you look at it from, be the devil's advocate for a minute, oh yeah, well, everyone's in prison because they're guilty before the fact. And so, oddly enough, it reminds me of that stat that we'd often hear over the years, that the United States has 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners. And I always thought, when I look at that, I was like, yeah, well, that's terrible. That's not justice. That ain't right. It can't be right. And we can definitely do better than that from an objective standpoint. But at the same time, if you look around much of the world, you'd notice that part of the reason that China doesn't seem to have many prisoners, and besides the fact that they would lie about it anyway, regardless, is the fact that their whole society is a prison. They don't have prisoners because the society itself is a prison. It's built as so. Now, as a result, you might feel a little safer walking down the street. Maybe. I don't know. Honestly, I haven't quite been there. I haven't been there myself. But that's what you get with totalitarian dictatorships, with authoritarianism like that. It's that adherence to security over freedom that is the greatest ruse that's ever been pulled, wool over the eyes of the free people of this world, warped our minds and gets us to be afraid of our own shadow, such that when someone comes over and says, hey, I'll protect you from your shadow, end up throwing money at them and bowing down to whatever grifter shows up to make some sort of claim that is clearly nonsense. And they gain power for it themselves and control. And that's to be avoided again. So when you look at that, be like 25% of the world's prisoners, yeah, well, that's because we have a free society. Not perfectly free. There are various ways in which it's the system we have has been gamed, and we can go into the subject matter knowledge of this sort of thing that can be determined. But for the most part, we have a free society that allows for some people to be psychos, sociopaths, to be crazies, and do all sorts of damage. And so, when they do, we put them away. Put them in prison for a while. So that's what you're going to have in a free society, to a certain extent. Now, I argue we could do a whole heck of a lot better than this. And the ideas which I've brought up, these Great Awakenings, this series of big ideas, most recently are my, how do you say, prescription to improve the society that we do have. Now, it doesn't happen overnight, of course, and might not even happen while I'm alive. Maybe not. But eventually we'll advance this kingdom and be in a better place. Also, so anyway, back to the start of this story. So I was at this bar with my friend, with a shuffleboard next to us, and I was telling them about all these things that just don't make logical sense, and he had watched the documentaries too concerning 9/11 and the unanswered questions and the breaks in logic that were used in order to provide a total story that leaves out the inside job portion of it, particularly in this case. There's some aspect of it that was perpetrated by the deep state, so to speak. To what extent, we don't exactly know. But I was telling him about this. I was like, how can we live in a society where the population just allows this to happen, where we ignore the basics of Newtonian physics and structural engineering and the fact that steel only melts at a certain temperature that was not reached through jet fuel, or and in particular when it comes to World Trade Center 7, that somehow the steel was melted by office furniture fires on a particular floor. Like, this is, it's nonsense. Absolutely nonsense. And even the National Institute of Standards and Technology came out, and they got paraded around by whoever, for whatever reason, in order to perpetuate a lie like that. I mean, that just does not speak well at all to a harmonious and prosperous existence for our society. Because what you're doing is you're attacking the basic logic of the world. You're attacking that process. You're attacking that methodology. You know, it's one thing to have some sort of subject matter that, you know, who knows? I mean, who really did it? Where were they at the time? You know, I didn't see that sort of thing. But when it's clear that a building falls down without any resistance from the structural integrity of the floors, drops at free fall speed like that, that's controlled demolition. It just is. Particularly with Building 7. It just is. Now, how that came about, I don't know. Who did it? I don't know. But to perpetuate that lie is to destroy Newtonian physics that has been responsible for an astounding amount of technological progress that we've made in the last 400 years. Like, are you kidding? You can't. To push that upon the population, it causes a cognitive dissonance. It causes a break in that logical process. It causes a break in the basic processor or the methodology of our minds to say that and to perpetuate that. You're doing damage to everyone in society, to the individuals, to the way we, you know, speak to each other. You're doing damage to science itself. You're doing damage to technological progress. You're doing damage to all the philosophies. You're doing damage to all of the traditional manner of anything and everything. Like, you're talking about telling people that 2 + 2 = 5. Again, I'm not going to accept that. And you don't need to accept it either. Nobody does. At all. Now, if some authoritative figure comes up and stands on a gilded stage with some corrupted megaphone and then says that you must, then I'm sorry, I'm going to stop listening to him. Period. There's no reason to listen to any of these people at all. They can spit this nonsense all day and all night long for the rest of their lives. There's no reason that anyone needs to listen to this. And we're talking, of course, we're talking here about the virus panic as well, which is 90% lies. I mean, if I had to speculate a little bit, I'd say that 9/11 was maybe, 20% lies, something like that, the official story, so to speak. But this virus panic is 90%. I mean, we are really, we're pushing the scales here, my friends, you know, in this Twilight Zone Ministry of Truth madness. You know, it's really crazy. And again, the exact details, I don't know. But what I can tell you is where the stories don't make sense to a standing logic and methodology that is completely unbroken, and it's how do you say? Theoretical rigor. Because Newtonian physics only breaks down when you're talking about looking at the speed of light or subatomic particles. Like, it doesn't, you know, these are at extremes that we don't operate in. You know, the day-to-day world operates under Newtonian physics. You got three rules. You got three basic foundational rules. Mass times acceleration equals force. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And that's particularly when it comes to building seven, when it comes to telling the difference between a natural structural failure and a controlled demolition. It is that second law of Newtonian mechanics that is broken by Building 7. And that is that those underlying floors, so it's a 47-story building, and those underlying floors have a resistance to anything that hits them. So if you hit a wall with your hand, you hit the wall, but the wall also hits you at the same time. Which is why if you punch a wall, it's probably going to, well, depending on the wall, but but if you're hitting like a concrete wall, it's going to do more damage to your knuckles than you're going to do to the concrete. And so in a similar manner, all of those floors that make up the building have their own resistance that needs to be overcome by some overpowering force. So you need to, and rather than, you know, that pancake style in which they fell down, in order to bring down a building like that in the manner that it supposedly happened, you'd have to have like a super large jackhammer that ka-junk, 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 ka-junk. You'd have to have one floor that was a giant jackhammer that bang, bang, bang hit on the next floor that bang, bang, bang jackhammered down, bang, bang, bang as it goes, in order for that to operate. But anyway, that was a glaring, hole in the official story. And that was one of the times that we got hosed big time as a people and as a society, as Americans. Not only the fact that it was just one of the crimes of the century, greatest crime of the century until, you know, most recently with the virus panic, but and it being just a straight up terrorist attack on all of our faith and trust in each other. But it's an attack on a basic logic as well. And I find those sort of attacks much worse than someone who simply lies about subject matter because it attacks a much more important part of our minds, and that is the logic and methodology processor that we all have that determines the reality around us. So I'd like to impart that to you, the importance of the method, the importance of logic and the process that we utilize in order to determine our reality, and that we need to hang on to, because if we don't have that, then we don't have much. It's pretty important stuff. So this has been the Maverick Radio Hour. I am your host, and coming to you from West Bottoms, Kansas City. Much love to all of y'all. Take care of each other, and I will see you next time. Peace.